Hello, fellow foodies. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you're listening to the Foodie Pharmacology Podcast. I'm recording this episode remotely from a gorgeous location high in the mountains of the Rugova region in Kosovo. Just outside of my window is a breathtaking vista of rocky mountains covered in a broadleaf forest. I'm here on an ethnobotanical research expedition with local collaborators to document the uses of wild plants as food and medicine, and to collect some specimens of those plants for deposit in their herbarium, which is much like a plant museum with plant specimens pressed flat, dried, and glued to paper. If properly cared for, these specimens can last for centuries and will serve as an important record for generations of future scientists. In our 15th episode on the show, we're going to investigate an interesting group of plants that we've been hunting for in the wild across the mountainous terrain of Kosovo, which is a small country situated in the Balkans that borders with Albania, Montenegro, Macedonia, and Serbia. Orchids belong to the Orchidaceae family. Many of you plant lovers may even have a lovely orchid decorating your home or office or garden. Many of the orchids sold commercially are propagated through cell culture techniques so as not to deplete local wild collections. Orchids aren't just for beauty, though. Some of them are even edible. One edible example you may be familiar with is vanilla. Vanilla comes from the fruit pod of an orchid species that is native to Central America. Here in the Balkans, though, there are several species that are consumed, with the underground tubers of the orchid being harvested to create a special beverage or even ice cream ingredient called salep. Are you intrigued yet? I am. Let's dig in. Orchids have a long history of medicinal and food use, but over-harvesting for commercial trade has led many species to reach a point of being threatened or even endangered. As a result, the movement of any wild-harvested orchid specimen across country borders is restricted by international regulations under CITES, or the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. The harvest of edible orchids presents some interesting challenges for conservation biologists. On one hand, local harvesters depend on the collection and sale of these species and other wild medicinal plants to support their family's income. But on the other hand, there are concerns about how sustainable these current harvesting practices are. So to put it simply, things are complicated. Luckily for us, we have an expert on orchids and the sourcing of many different edible wild plants that has joined our team for the research expedition. Suzanne Masters works on botanical ingredient selection and sourcing for distilleries and skincare companies, catching landscapes and local cultures within a bottle for the Boatyard Distillery, Isle of Harris Gin, and other distilleries, and taking an endangered species out of cosmeceuticals. She writes about botanicals for the American Distilling Institute. As an ethnobotanist working on research at Naturalis Biodiversity Center and the University of Leiden, Suzanne is interested in orchids as resources. Bearing in mind that threats to wild plant populations are caused by their social and economic values, Suzanne investigates options for supporting livelihoods of local people while maintaining wild plant populations, and explores possibilities presented by the horticultural propagation and cultivation of these species. Her research has significant applications for the conservation of biodiversity, livelihoods tied to wild harvesting, and of traditional foods and medicines. Suzanne is a member of the IUCN Species Survival Commission Medicinal Plant Specialist Group and the IUCN SSC Orchid Specialist Group. I'm so excited to have the opportunity to speak with Suzanne about salep ingredients from the Balkans. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about your perspective on salep, or maybe just by starting with a description of what is salep. What does that word even mean?
So salep is used to describe the orchids that are used for salep, and it's the word used for a drink made from the orchid roots, and it's also the word for the powder made from the orchid roots that's used to make the drink salep and the chewy ice cream Maraschnon Durma. So people collect the orchid tubers, dry them, and then they're sold, and then before they reach the end consumer, they'll be powdered. And that orchid root powder is added to milk, and it makes a drink that has a little bit of a distinctive taste, But the key component of the salep that you really notice is the slipperiness, the viscosity it gives to that drink. And that drink's used, it's a winter drink. And also it's something that people might drink medicinally. So if you have a bit of a cough or a cold or some gastrointestinal complaints, you might drink salep. And that's within the Eastern Mediterranean. So around Greece, where it's called salepi, in Turkey, where it's called salep, and then around the Mediterranean down into Syria and Israel as well. And that's where it's thought of as a traditional food or food drink slash medicine.
So this is really a medicinal food then. And you mentioned that it's drunk during winter. Is this a hot beverage or is it taken cold? How is it prepared most commonly?
It's a hot beverage. And in Istanbul, in Turkey, you can actually still see in the winter, there'll be guys walking around pushing carts with a steaming metal container on that cart. And they'll be calling out salep. And if you want a drink, you'll stop and you'll have a little drink. It's almost like a street food snack. And it's that hot drink is very seasonal for winter. But in the summer, you have the ice cream, which is essentially, it's, you know, when you make ice cream, you combine your ingredients and then you freeze them. And when you do that with salep, which already has this viscosity, you get an ice cream that's almost chewy. In some areas, it's made to be so stiff, you eat it with a knife and fork.
Wow.
And also, it's associated with this wonderful display of skills where the person selling Maraştan Dürüm, they'll pound it with a long metal pole to keep it flexible, and then they'll twirl that metal pole with the ice cream on it. So there's a couple of kilos of ice cream spinning around. It's a little bit like baton twirling, that coordination, and they never drop the ice cream. And then if you go to buy your ice cream from them, they'll use that long metal pole to scoop out the ice cream and put it in the cone. But before you can actually eat your ice cream, you'll have to catch it. So they'll be spinning that pole and you'll get hold of the cone and then they'll whip the ice cream off the top, or you'll have the cone and they'll whip the ice cream and the cone out of your hand. And then when they're ready, when you've worked hard enough, they'll let you have your ice cream.
So it's kind of like a game.
Oh, it's a great game. And also, someone also let me have a go at twirling the pole with the ice cream on it. And the weight of the pole and the ice cream together is quite big. And I was really impressed by the dexterity and the strength, that because this display of twirling the ice cream around, it just looks so effortless. And actually, it's something that takes a lot of practice and skill.
So let's talk a bit more about the actual plant ingredients, because when we say salep, does that actually refer to one species of orchid, or what does that really refer to?
It refers to a group of orchids. It's not just one orchid. And there's about 30,000 species of orchids in the world. About 60% of those are epiphytes. So they grow in trees and they're really associated with tropical areas where there's moisture in the air. But that leaves 40% of orchids that grow in the ground. So they'll have roots in the ground. And of those, I mean, orchids diversity is concentrated in the tropics, you know, like most biodiversity. But even so, there's around more than 100 to perhaps about 200, or it's a bit variable because we're not entirely clear on what a species means for orchids when they hybridize so easily and they make hybrid swarms. And you can have one species with many different forms, but actually it's genetically the same and it's not in a discrete population. So there's a bit of complexity to saying how many species of orchids we have in this region, but we can say there are several genera that are used to make salep. So ophrys, which are bee orchids that have little fuzzy flowers. In Turkey, they call them cat's paw orchids because the fuzziness they think is like the little short velvety fur on a cat's paws.
And are these terrestrial orchids? Are they growing in the ground, or do we find those in trees?
These are all growing in the ground. And then you have the Dactylorhiza, which are marsh orchids, and they tend to grow in damp ground. We also have Anacanthus. And these are the main groups that we think are in salep that's being traded. at the moment, but some of my work, we've been looking at salep that's been traded in the past. So we can find salep traded in the past by going to economic botany collections or materia medica collections, because it was also used as a medicinal. And we've been taking samples of from those tubers that are held in those collections, and we're working on analyzing the DNA, which will tell us what those species were, because as a root, it's quite hard to tell them apart. So I can tell a Dactylorhiza is different from an Ophrys, but I don't know which species of Dactylorhiza. And a Hemantoglossum, we know, are in the old collections. They make quite big tubers, but on market samples at the moment, we're not really seeing many of those Hemantoglossum tubers, and that's probably in relation to their scarcity.
So in botany, I guess one thing that people may not be familiar with among our listeners is, how do you identify an orchid species? So you mentioned that in some of the economic botany collections, there may be jars of these old tubers, but what are the essential parts that you need to see to identify a botanical specimen? Can't we just snip off some DNA source and sequence it and sort it out? Or are there other methods that are really needed?
We can analyze DNA, but that's on the basis that you have reference collections. And also analyzing DNA is quite expensive and it uses a lot of equipment. So really, when we're in the field and going around looking at orchids, there are some that you just know because you're familiar with them. And there are some that you know the genus, and then you might check with a flora, an identification guide. Or you might go and check in a herbarium. And one of the really cool things we're doing here is getting some samples for the herbarium at the University of Pristina to build up the collection there. So that means in future times, if someone finds a Plantanthera orchid here or a Dactylorhiza, they can go to the herbarium in the University of Pristina and compare it with other local specimens.
Yeah, and I know that they're also working on sequencing the DNA from the specimens that we're collecting, so that will be tied to those herbarium specimens for others to reference.
Yes, yeah. It will. And also we know that to a certain extent, it seems that you might be able to tell regions of where you've collected a species from the DNA. So it's really useful to have those original reference specimens in the herbarium in University of Pristina, and then link that to the information from the DNA, so that we're getting a profile of what does this species look like? What does it look like here in Kosovo? And also, what does its DNA look like?
Yeah. And so you mentioned earlier that some of these salep orchids are not only sold, but also used by local people as a source of like a medicinal food. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about some of the medicinal food applications of salep?
Well, probably the oldest reference to salep as medicine is actually in medieval Cairo. It was in a shopping list of a physician. They were getting materials they were using as medicine, and salep is on there. So we know it's been used for many centuries, actually, as a medicinal. And it tends to be with the alimentary canal, if you've got a sore throat and also, or maybe a little bit upset stomach, and also with coughs and colds. And that seems to be associated with that slippery property that's soothing.
So it's kind of a demulcent type factor to it. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. And I know that besides their food and medicine uses, that you've actually been researching a number of other uses of orchids, even industrial uses. Can you share anything about that?
Yeah, so I've been looking at, there's a tendency when you're looking at wild harvest ingredients in conservation science literature, there has been a lot of publications where the attribution of why wild populations are declining is placed on the shoulders of people who are doing the wild harvesting. And I was really interested in, with salep, how maybe are there other consumers? Is it just a traditional food and medicine? So I went through a different set of archives, and what I found is actually that there has been commercial interest in salep for everything from coating on in thread to make it easier to spin, and that was in the 1800s. That it has colloidal properties that are of interest in manufacturing explosives, that its ability to be slippery.
Wait a second. Did you just say to manufacture explosives from an orchid?
Yes, I did.
That's interesting.
So when you're eating salep as a food or a drink, that texture is coming from a molecule called glucomannan. And the thing about salep and the glucomannan it contains is that it has the ability to be distributed evenly throughout the medium, and those particles don't drop down to the bottom. So, and if you're manufacturing explosives, what you want is that even distribution of your components, and it needs to be stable until the point at which you ignite it and require it to be unstable. So in this weird route, yes, an orchid can be used to manufacture an explosive.
Fascinating. What? Let's talk a bit more about conservation. Mm. And earlier in the episode, I mentioned something called CITES and how CITES controls the international trade of wild orchids. Can you maybe expand a bit more on that and what that actually means?
So what it means is that if you're going to move, all orchids are listed in Appendix 2 of CITES. There are some orchid species listed in Appendix 1, and Appendix 1 means essentially that you can't move those orchids across international boundaries. Appendix 2 means that you need to apply for a permit, and the permit will be awarded on the basis that it's not unsustainable wild collection, or it might be laboratory grown, because some orchids are very easily grown in laboratories. And if you've got you propagate them and you'll have a flask, and at the seedling stage, you can see them in a flask. It's obvious they're not wild collected. So actually you don't actually need the permit for that kind of movement where it's clearly propagated. But what CITES in theory does is it controls trade through people applying for permits to the CITES authority in their country. So you have import permits and export permits. But in practice, we know salep is being traded in countries where the orchids used to make salep don't naturally grow. And also where, as far as our research group is aware, there is not commercial cultivation on a large scale. So we have countries where the salep doesn't grow naturally in the wild, and no one is growing it in enough bulk to sell it commercially, but salep is there. So we know that salep is going across boundaries without permits and without regulated trade. And we also know that in some regions, people are very concerned about harvesting levels and saying that the wild orchid populations are declining.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that we've noted in a number of our field studies in the Balkans is the importance of these wild species, orchids, but also other medicinal species for supporting local household incomes. We know in many of the villages where we've done some research, there's a lot of potato cultivation, which is interesting because potatoes come from the Andes, but have since found a home here in cultivation in the Balkans. But I think that these medicinal species really help to support family income and their ability to purchase necessary supplies. So I know that you also have a lot of background in sustainable product development and in developing ways to work with local communities to create a sustainable market. I was wondering if you could expand on that. What are some of the things that are being explored in that avenue for orchids?
Well, with reference to salep in particular and some of the other experiments that I'm running, what we're looking at, one is to find out which species are actually being used. And then following on from that, we've been looking at sustainable harvesting methods, and we're finding that there is a difference, that it seems that some genera, like Dactylorhiza, don't tolerate disturbance, whereas one of the other genera does tolerate disturbance. And if you replant after removing a tuber, there is some regrowth. So that actually suggests that there's a possibility with some species, if you're working with collectors, that they might replant them and you'll get some regrowth. There's also the possibility with species that don't tolerate disturbance that we'd be looking at working out sustainable harvesting by methods that work for that community. And that could be people harvesting 2 out of 10 plants in their patch, or it could be as a community agreeing, we'll harvest from this area this year and then we'll leave it and we'll harvest from a different area next year. And it could also be what one person that we spoke to this week was talking about, how he harvests after the seed pods burst open. He believes that the tubers are a better quality, but actually if you harvest after the seed pods have burst open, you're leaving the seeds there, so you're going to get new plants being recruited and joining the ranks and then becoming mature. So although you're removing mature plants, you're allowing the population to have a chance at regenerating. So that's another interesting method that could be used.
So one thing that caught my attention earlier was that you mentioned this historic creation of ice cream. And I'm just wondering, historically, if there was no ice in the region or this pre-refrigeration, how is ice cream made without ice?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because some, you know, people have said to me, but, you know, Maharashtra ice cream must be a modern invention, because how could they have, people have been making ice cream in the Mediterranean where it's hot in the summer before there was electricity to create artificial freezing. Actually, people did, and it was potentially as early as the 1500s or even earlier. We know there was a French traveler in the region, Pierre Berlon, and in his diaries, he describes the ice houses that they built in Turkey. And they're slightly different from the ice houses of the time in France. And we know people built ice houses in England as well. So this technique of building a low building with a lot of the walls and the bottom surface sort of buried deep in the ground, with thick walls, no windows, layering straw again for insulation. So creating this building that would keep things cold. And also, if you look into the records in Turkey, which was then, well, at various times, it was part of the Byzantine Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and now it's more, a lot of it is modern day Turkey. And if you look into this, there's actually a word in Turkish for the snow collectors, the karacar. And they would take snow from the mountains and then they would keep it in ice houses. And then in the summer, that meant in Istanbul, then Constantinople, you could make things like sherbet and ice cream because the snow collectors brought out their ice.
Wow. That's amazing. And so, and then they were using also salep with this ice or snow to make their desserts. That's fascinating. Great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add about salep in general or its future as an ingredient?
I think it does have a future as an ingredient, and that's going to be on the basis of possibly working with local collectors and working with them to work out how the wild harvest can be sustainable. And also because those rural incomes where you can harvest wild plants on land that you don't own are really important, because if you only look at horticulture as a solution, what you're doing is you're placing that income in the hands of people who own land and already have good access to markets. And actually, that doesn't stop wild harvesting. All it does is sometimes provide a route for wild harvested ingredients to be laundered. And it's important to give people ownership of the resources around themselves. And I don't think we want to see a future where people in mountainous regions of the Balkans or Turkey have plants around them that other people are using, other people are making a lot of money out of, and they're cut out of it because their option for utilizing it or gaining market access is only via cultivation, which may not be possible.
Yeah. So, like I said, it's complicated, right? But I think that it is a fascinating aspect of ethnobotany, of how people use plants. And hopefully, I really hope this ingredient will find its way into a broader sustainable market in the future, because it really is a delicious thing to taste that has some fascinating properties. Great. Well, thank you so much, Suzanne, for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Who knew that orchids could be so fascinating, delicious, and an important part of household economics in the Balkans? Remember, though, not all orchids are edible, and you should definitely not eat the tubers of any orchids that you may have growing in your home or office. There are literally thousands of species out there, and only a small fraction of those are useful for human consumption. Also, whenever buying orchids to decorate your home or garden, avoid the purchase of any wild specimens. Every purchasing decision matters when it comes to the economic pressures that impact the conservation of biodiversity of wild species. Next time on Foodie Pharmacology, we'll be joined by Professor Avni Hajdari, my longtime collaborator and expert on the wild plants of Kosovo. We're going to discuss the traditional use of a wild plant as a mountain tea, locally known as chai mali. This fragrant ingredient comes from the Lamiaceae or mint family. You may also be more familiar with its use as a seasoning for pizza and pasta, but in the Balkans, this ingredient is most valued for tea. So join me next time on location in the Shari Mountains of Kosovo as we explore the amazing uses of wild oregano or Origanum vulgare. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the podcast for the food curious, recorded on location in the Rugova Mountain region in Kosovo. Get updates on our latest episodes by following or liking the Foodie Pharmacology Facebook page. You can subscribe to the podcast on SoundCloud or iTunes. Be sure to spread the word and tell your friends. If you've got a great idea for a future show, reach out to me on social media. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at QuaveEthnobot, spelled Q-U-A-V-E-E-T-H-N-O-B-O-T. I'll see you next time.